It is colorful, fun, and really addictive. We're talking about the hit mobile game Candy Crush Saga. The maker of the game started trading publicly yesterday and got crushed. King Digital Entertainment's stock sank, which could be a sign that investors are losing faith in the mobile gaming market, as NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
You play Candy Crush by trying to line up at least three of the same color candies. In February, an average of 144 million daily active users got sucked into that challenge. But Candy Crush is one of more than 180 games made by King Digital Entertainment, and it alone brought in three-quarters of the company's revenue in the last quarter of 2013. Roger Kay, president of research firm Endpoint Technologies Associates, says to a lot of investors, it sounds like Farmville, the hit game by Zynga that Zynga can't seem to do again.
It's very difficult to replicate the alchemy of a great hit. Even the very same makers of that game can't necessarily come up with another one that's going to be just as popular.
Kay says the market may also be getting a little bubbly. There have been high-priced acquisitions, like Facebook's purchase of the virtual reality company Oculus VR for $2 billion. That two-year-old company has no revenue.
So people are paying a lot for what appears to be not very much.
Still, Kay says King Digital has been a profitable company since 2005. It posted over $700 million before taxes last year, and it does have a potential hit on the horizon with Farm Hero Saga, which has seen momentum and popularity since its launch in January. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
All right, this is a little scary. You want to know what accounts for a third of all the data pulled down from the internet in North America? That would be Netflix and all the movies and shows being streamed there. As some of you probably know, all that traffic means it can take a while to load videos. Well, Netflix would love to smooth out that experience, but that would mean upgrading the infrastructure. And who's going to pay for that? Netflix or the internet service providers? Zoe Chase with her Planet Money team takes us into the tubes.
We're going to trace one simple internet request, one that lots of people have made lately.
Hi, my name is Rachel Margolis. I'm in Brooklyn in my apartment. And we're about to watch House of Cards.
Spotsylvania behind us if you are. I want nothing more.
And what's going on?
Still no idea.
It turns out that getting this episode from Netflix to here is at least as complicated as what happened in season two of House of Cards.
When someone's on the ropes, that's when you throw a combination to the gut and a left hook to the jaw.
So, where does your internet come from?
That cable thingy in my wall.
Do you know what happens on the other side of the wall?
No. No.
What's happening on the other side of the wall is a battle of sorts. A battle between Netflix and the internet service providers. Companies like Time Warner, who brought the cord into Rachel's apartment. To explain the issue, let's follow Rachel's request to play House of Cards. Rachel clicks, the request travels out on the cable to a box on the corner.
And the sticker says, Time Warner Cable of New York City.
Time Warner sends it across the river to this magical place in Manhattan.
You're at 111 8th Avenue.
It's so big.
Third largest building, so you assume Empire State Building, but just turned on its side.
This is Ben Gagne of a company called Telex. The Time Warner cables come into this building, so do all the cables of all the different providers and a lot of the companies who use them, the Yahoos, the Googles, the Twitters. This place is where all these companies talk to each other. It's called a carrier hotel, and they're in lots of cities. But the real action here is in what you might think of as the hotel bar. This is where all of the different parts of the internet meet.
So what we're walking into now is the building Meet Me Room.
The Meet Me Room.
This is the Meet Me Room.
Meet Me Room. They call it the Meet Me Room.
Just wires.
Just wires, right?
Everywhere.
I mean,
this is a crucial moment for Rachel's request, because up till now, all the wires have been paid for by Time Warner, and it's about to move into the world where Netflix pays the bills. Netflix has made deals with a lot of companies that have pipes that come into this room, and boom, Rachel's request is out, heading to one of the places where House of Cards is kept. Maybe New York, or maybe
Northern Virginia, Chicago, Atlanta, Miami.
And this is the guy who gets it off the shelf. Dave Schaefer is CEO of Cogent, one of the many companies that Netflix uses to get your videos. They own a bunch of pipes, and their job is to get the video as fast as possible.
On average, that request will actually travel 2,400 miles.
Finally. Actually, this whole thing only takes like a millisecond. But finally, Netflix is giving Rachel what she asked for, and the episode takes pretty much the same route back.
Miami.
This is the Mimi Room.
Time Warner Cable.
Second season.
To the gut and a left hook to the jaw.
When millions of people are trying to do this at the same time, this is when Netflix gets slow. They need more pipes. They need more wires in the Meet Me Room. And so Netflix is doing a lot of deals right now. And they actually have a lot of options when it comes to getting their content from Miami and Atlanta back to New York. But the last mile...
When it delivers data to Rachel in Brooklyn, at some point, its set of choices are reduced.
Shane Greenstein teaches the business of the internet at Chicago's Kellogg School.
At some point, it has to cut a deal with Time Warner. At some point, it has to go over Time Warner pipe.
This is why there are fights right now between Netflix and internet service providers, because it comes down to who's going to pay to upgrade the service, keep the videos running smoothly. The Netflixes, who are pouring all this data into the pipes, or the Time Warners, whose customers, like Rachel, are demanding it. Zoe Chase, NPR News.
A German-based group called Pedia Press is trying to raise enough money to do the impossible. They want to print a copy of Wikipedia. Yep, a print version of the constantly evolving, endlessly edited, crowdsourced online encyclopedia. To say this would be a massive project is an understatement. To say it makes sense, well, that's a whole different issue, NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
1,000 volumes, 1,200 pages each, more than 1 million pages in all, about 80 meters of shelf space. That's what it would take to make a printed version of Wikipedia. The idea, says Christoph Kepper of Pedia Press, is to let people see just how much information is in the online encyclopedia.
Nowadays, you just use Wikipedia every day without even thinking how large that might be. I mean, the English Wikipedia has 4.5 million articles. Nobody can imagine this number. It's only when you see this in print or in a physical form that you realize how large it really is.
Kepper and his partners are trying to raise $50,000 through an Indiegogo campaign. Their plan is to exhibit the book at a Wikimania conference in London in August.
We basically thought, okay, let's put up a big bookshelf and put the books into it and let as many people as possible access this shelf and interact with it and just get the feeling of, about how large it is by, for themselves.
This is not an idea that I think is good.
Lee Matthew is a blogger for Geek.com. He thinks a printed Wikipedia is unnecessary, a waste of paper and other valuable resources.
I understand from an artistic standpoint what they're trying to show. I think, though, that the beauty of what Wikipedia is gets lost when you try to print it. It's a constantly evolving thing. Trying to put something like Wikipedia that is constantly evolving into a print form just doesn't work for me.
Pedia Press is sensitive to the criticism that a printed Wikipedia would use a lot of paper. In fact, they're going to plant trees to make up for the paper they use. That makes Jordan Taylor, who writes for BetaBeat, feel a lot better about the project.
I totally get it. I totally get where they're coming from. Because, you know, when we look back at media history, we can look at old books, we can look at old newspapers, old magazines, but there's no way to really go back and look at the history of the internet. And I'm imagining us teaching kids in the future about the history of the internet, and how are we really going to go back and show them what it looked like in the 1990s and the 2000s?
In fact, the partners at Pedia Press say they do think of this as a period piece. After it's shown at next summer's conference, they would love to find a more permanent home for it. Matthew Winner, a blogger and elementary school librarian, says he'd like to see that happen.
This is public knowledge, so putting it somewhere on display where the whole public can access it, you know, New York Public Library or something like that where everyone has access to it. The Library of Congress, I think that's a wonderful idea. You know, we have the user data of how many people are accessing and interacting with Wikipedia online now. It'd be fun to see how many people are coming to see that print resource. And that's something that we will only know after it's printed.
Winner says a lot of people, including many librarians, are skeptical of Wikipedia as a reliable research tool. But he thinks seeing the encyclopedia in print might change some of those attitudes. And Winner loves that at the exhibit next summer, they plan to have printers kind of like old newswire machines that will constantly create updates.
I think that might even be more interesting than the Wikipedia printout itself, just for us to watch how quickly people are interacting with the document.
But one thing they can't do, says blogger Jordan Taylor, is edit the printed version itself.
That's the inherent fun of Wikipedia. You know, sometimes you stumble across a paragraph that definitely shouldn't be there, and it's a little alarming, but I think that's sort of the, you know, you have to love Wikipedia, warts and all.
Pedia Press still has a lot of money to raise with its campaign, which will come to an end on April 11th. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Stormy weather over the southern Indian Ocean today once again squelched the search for Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. Bad weather may be a recurring problem there as the southern hemisphere edges toward winter. Satellite data points investigators to those remote seas. There have also been satellite images of floating objects, but so far no debris have been positively identified, and the search area is still huge. Experts say the disappearance of the Boeing jet wouldn't be such a mystery if it had been streaming its location data. Here's NPR's Brian Naylor.
Flight 370 disappeared from radar screens when the plane's transponder, which sends out its location, for some reason stopped transmitting. But what if the Boeing 777 had streamed at least some of the data out in real time? We might have a much clearer picture of what happened to the plane and why. Advocates have been calling on airlines to install such devices for years. Matt Bradley is president of Flight Aerospace Solutions, a Canadian company that's developed a system that can transmit data continuously or when triggered by an unexpected event like engine failure or cabin depressurization.
In the event that that happens, an alert is sent to the airline operational control center where a screen lights up, there's an oral alert, and there is, in no uncertain terms do you know, there's an abnormality on that aircraft and we need to look out.
Computer science professor Krishna Kavi of the University of North Texas says not all of the data available in a black box needs to be streamed in real time.
So if you are on the ocean and satellite is expensive, only send your altitude, your direction of travel, or GPS coordinates if you want, and the state of the engines. Are they running okay? So minimal information, you know, that you need. So that you detect there's something wrong, then you ask for additional information.
The Malaysia Airline jet's last contact was with a satellite system run by Inmarsat. The company's vice president, Chris McLaughlin, says technology is already available to send short bursts of data every few minutes. He says the Air France jetliner that went down in the Atlantic in 2009 had that technology, and it meant recovery crews could quickly narrow the search area. The Malaysia Airline jet, McLaughlin says, did not.
The Air France had elected to adopt a system of bursting information from the plane every 4 minutes. Malaysian, because it's not mandated, didn't do anything. Now, that's nobody's fault, that's just not mandated. I mean, if one thing is to come out of this tragedy, it should be that all aircraft are mandated to give their position at a regular interval.
Cost is clearly one obstacle to more widespread deployment of streaming technology. The system developed by the Canadian firm Flight would cost airlines $100,000 per plane to install. Another concern involves the pilots, who see too much information readily available as an invasion of their privacy. Sean Cassidy is first vice president of the Airline Pilots Association International, the Pilots Union. Cassidy, an Alaska Airlines captain, is fine with aircraft streaming more data, but he draws the line at cockpit conversations.
Say I go on an 8-hour trip with my co-pilot, and every single conversation that we say, every single personal story, stories about our families and everything else, is being streamed live to somewhere. How is that information going to be safeguarded?
It will likely take the FAA to mandate real-time data transmissions for them to be adopted by all carriers. The agency's next-generation air traffic control system is based on satellite navigation, but it's unclear when next-gen will be fully in place. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
Tijuana, Mexico stands so close to the U.S. border, the city practically leans on the fence. We drove through the city with NPR's Carrie Kahn.
This was the original border fence. That's all there was. Now you'll see there's a road, a dirt road, and then there is another fence, which are pylons. And then you'll see in some places there's actually a third fence.
We met Carrie Kahn as we neared the end of our road trip along the border. She's our Mexico City correspondent and has covered Tijuana off and on for two decades. She's an enthusiast for a city that is in many ways still developing.
Can you drink the water in Tijuana?
No.
But also strikingly modern. Visitors to India are told not to drink the tap water either, yet India became a powerhouse for the tech business. And Carrie Kahn took us to see how Tijuana is reaching for a piece of that internet economy. Tijuana wants business that usually goes to Asia.
Where we're driving right now used to be a residential neighborhood, and you can see in there are spots where there's some new architecture. And we're going to go down this driveway right here. Stop, 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 stop. We're going down this driveway right here. And that is the Mind Hub right there.
That was our destination, a wide-windowed office building with outdoor stairs.
Typical Tijuana, you have a very architecturally new, dynamic place right next to a shack. And here is one of the oldest families in Tijuana that raise roosters for cockfights. So it's the old and the new, and it's quite a mixture.
Carrie led us up to the roof of the tech building, which she described as a business incubator. Tijuana has modern foreign-owned factories, or maquiladoras, as do many Mexican border cities, but the entrepreneurs at MindHub are aiming for something more. They want to work with U.S. tech companies across the border.
They do software design, they do software support, they make apps, and one of the founders is Jorge Arroyo.
This whole building was conceptualized basically as a working space for to collaborate and kind of converge.
Arroyo, born and raised in Tijuana, launches into his rapid-fire business pitch. He's excited about his building, his company, and helping out other young engineers. He sees Tijuana becoming an outsourcing hub for U.S. companies, bigger than Beijing or Bangalore.
These companies traditionally do it in the India, not or usually associated with horror stories in terms of time difference, cultural mismatch, and so forth. They find a way more improved alternative doing here in Mexico.
And especially, he says, in Tijuana, which is graduating top-rated engineers. Arroyo's MindHub team helps new graduates develop and market their ideas, like new apps for kids with autism and custom Spanish language accounting programs. Arroyo says his giving back model is a break from Mexico's usually top-down business culture.
We were trying to be disruptive in that sense. I mean, we've been very much committed, walking the talk, so to speak, of reinvesting it. But aside from that is this whole bet on entrepreneurship and innovation.
This isn't the first time Tijuana has bet on reinvention. Business leaders have long tried to entice more technical companies in attempts to move beyond low-wage, low-value manufacturing. However, this new breed of young entrepreneurs is doing it themselves. Check out 3D Robotics, the company's Tijuana general manager, Guillermo Romero Mendez, shows off its number one seller, a small four-propeller battery-operated drone, which hovers over the production room floor. Romero and a childhood friend designed and manufactured the copter's autopilot out of their Tijuana apartments with backing from a San Diego entrepreneur. Romero says growing up on a steady diet of San Diego TV, cartoons in English, and lots of music videos got him to dream big.
They were, like, blowing my mind when I was watching all those videos. So it was part of the education here in this region. We grab a little bit from San Diego, we mix it with Latin culture, and we have a new thing.
Romero's new thing now has more than 100 employees and sales of $10 million last year. San Diego venture capitalist Bob Watkins says there are plenty of opportunities waiting in Tijuana. He's setting up a $20 million cross-border VC fund. But even though he's bullish on Tijuana, he says it's a challenge to get Mexican investors to loosen their purse strings and invest in startups.
I think it's symptomatic of just about every underserved economy that's growing and maturing. And I don't care whether you're in Mexico or in Great Britain or in Somalia. It's going to take time.
Mexico, it's a tough place to be an entrepreneur. It's starting to change, but still tough.
Juan Pardines runs a Mexico City think tank focusing on competition. He says Mexico doesn't have a culture of risk-taking. It's only been the last 15 years that the country has had relative economic stability. The previous three decades were dominated by one economic catastrophe after another. which Pardina says took a psychological toll on business people.
Here, failure is extremely costly. We need to create a culture where you could fail fast, where you could learn from your mistakes, and you could still have the drive and the energy to promote this entrepreneurial culture.
Tijuana's entrepreneurs, most in their early 30s, aren't afraid of the risks. Take Andres Reyes Botello and his 3D computer animation studio, Boxel, located in Tijuana's upscale Rio zone. He started with just a handful of artists 10 years ago and has grown to one of the largest CGI studios in Mexico. Last year, Botello convinced actor Edward James Olmos' production house to let him animate a full-length CGI feature film.
And as a good Mexican, of course, yes. You say yes, and then you figure it out.
He's kidding. The film is called El Americano, and it's about a group of parrots struggling to save their circus. It features Lisa Kudrow, Rico Rodriguez of Modern Family, and Cheech Marin as an evil bullying bird.
Well, well, if it isn't El Cappuccino coming to save the day. Well, you're too late, chocolate!
Botello delivered as promised. El Americano opens in U.S. movie houses later this year.
And NPR's Carrie Kahn delivered that report. She was in Tijuana, another of the correspondents who joined us as we traveled the length of the U.S.-Mexico border.
Several big retail stores have been hit by data breaches recently. Target, Neiman Marcus, Michaels, the list keeps growing as hackers continue to steal personal data and credit card information. The full extent of the damage to consumers is still unknown, but just imagine what a thief could do by digging into, say, your company's payroll records. Those contain your social security number, your date of birth, how much you earn. NPR's Jeff Brady reports that some people are finding out the hard way how damaging this sort of breach can be.
Near Rochester, New York, a man named Gary Blotto Valley recently tried to submit his federal tax return.
We were alerted by our accountant that our e-filing for our taxes was denied because one of our numbers had been used.
Turns out it's a common scam. A thief steals your social security number, then files a return and collects your refund. A few days later, his employer notified its workers that someone hacked into the company's payroll system. I should mention that Gary is a friend of mine, and that's probably one reason he's willing to talk about his experience. Many people in his situation are uncomfortable speaking publicly about a problem involving their employer. Gary works for Sorensen Communications, a company that provides services for people who are deaf. Because there's an investigation happening, the company declined NPR's interview request. Meanwhile, Gary has signed up for credit monitoring services and contacted the IRS trying to sort out the mess.
I'm sure I'll be spending tens and hundreds of hours on this stuff from here on out, and who knows, this is going to be the next year of my life.
Gary is not alone. We talked with others around the country who also experienced similar problems. A Chicago company that operates assisted living facilities learned in February that its payroll system was compromised. Monica Lang is vice president of corporate communications for Assisted Living Concepts, which recently changed its name to Enlivened. She says more than 43,000 current and former employees were affected.
Names, addresses, birth dates, social security numbers, and pay information were accessed by the unauthorized third parties.
The U.S. Department of Justice says 16.6 million people in the U.S. were victims of identity theft in 2012. It's not clear exactly how many people are victims of payroll system data breaches. Experts consulted for this story believe it's a small percent. But the consequences can be very serious. Not only can a thief buy things under your name, they can also get medical care, open new accounts, or even commit crimes using your identity. Monica Lang says her company notified employees as soon as possible. She says already some are experiencing problems.
We've partnered with the IRS and the FBI, and the investigation continues.
In San Diego at the Identity Theft Resource Center, President and CEO Eva Velasquez helps victims every day. She says if you're worried about the security of your employer's payroll records, ask questions.
And then you can even use this program as the catalyst for that conversation.
You know, hi, good morning, Joe. I just heard on the radio this really scary program about this data breach for payroll records, and it got me thinking, what do we do here to make sure that doesn't happen to us?
Velasquez says current laws governing how companies store data and notify victims of breaches vary from state to state. So businesses that operate in multiple states have to figure out how to comply with all those laws. Scott Vernick is a Philadelphia attorney who advises businesses on data security. His firm released an iPhone application that helps businesses navigate the 46 different state laws. He says most larger companies would prefer one federal standard.
It's just much harder when you're responding to 46 different statutory schemes as opposed to just one scheme.
On Capitol Hill, a few lawmakers have repeatedly introduced bills to strengthen federal data privacy laws. With more attention on data breaches now, they hope a bill will pass this year. Jeff Brady, NPR News.